Welcome back to Stack Trace, the podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspective. And now that I think about it, the fact that we include life there in the tagline kind of means that this podcast can be about anything because, well, anything is life, isn't it, Rambo?
Yes, absolutely. As I've been mentioning about me staying at home all this time, it's life, right?
Right, it's life. Life happens.
Yeah, so I'm going to include another fun fact in there. It's been like since, January, since I last had a haircut. So
it's, oh, wow.
It's getting out of control. And please send help.
Have you thought about cutting your own hair or using a razor or taking any other kind of drastic measures to fix this problem?
No, I'm not going to do that. I actually have... a place that's like 10 steps away from where I live, where I can go to. So probably just gonna do that. Should be fine. It's a small place.
But it's one of those things, right, where the way I feel about this, like, we don't have a lockdown here anymore. Like, you can go out, you can live your life more or less like normal. I mean, obviously, you should wear a mask whenever you're in a public place and things like that. But I still feel like if I don't have to do something, like... I did get a haircut a few weeks ago, and it was getting really bad by that point. Like, I was looking pretty much like I haven't been in civilization. Like, I've been in the jungle or something for several months. So I did get a haircut. But other than that, I've been feeling like I'm not sure if I want to do something that I don't really have to do. I'm kind of more staying on the safe side of things.
Yeah, me too. I'm on your side there. If I had to, like... take an Uber and go to the other side of the city to have a haircut, I wouldn't do it. But that, like, there's right. This place like literally right next door, and they're doing all of the safety measures, masks, and only like one client at a time and things like that. So I feel that's fairly benign. I don't think it's gonna be a big issue.
But sounds good.
I know what's not gonna be a big issue. It's see that segue there.
Oh yeah, I love a good segue. Yeah.
So what's completely opposite from an issue is what you've been doing with your game and Imagine Engine and Swift UI and our iMessage thread is basically like taking me back to my Super Nintendo days playing Zelda, and you've been tweeting some stuff as well about your game. So I want to know, John, how has it evolved since the last time we spoke?
It is actually quite astonishing just how much it has evolved just during the last week. I feel like I haven't been this productive in so many years. And it just goes to show that when you're working on something that you're really passionate about and that you really love and that you're really excited about, you can just get so much more done. Like, I'm looking at my commits, I'm looking at the screenshots I've shared with you and on Twitter, like the progress, and I almost can't believe it, because this is something that I haven't even been working on full time. I mean, I'm not a game developer as a full time job. I've been doing this as just a little side project. And I've been also using some of my research and development time kind of on this game, where, you know, I do spend a fair amount of hours every week on researching new kind of Swift techniques and trying out new things and getting inspiration for things like articles. Because like I mentioned before, I really want all of my articles to be anchored in and have the source being a real project. So not just something I came up with for the article. So I do spend some time on that, and I've been spending that time on the game. But I've been making a lot of progress. I think on the last episode, we talked about me building like the first menu. And now I have like the complete map editor is almost finished. Like, it's 90% done, which means that it's only 90% of the work left, right? And I'm starting now to implement some gameplay. Like, all the graphics are in. Like, it's starting to look like a real game, and I'm really excited about it. So yeah, I'm happy just to see how much I've been able to do. And the tools also that you mentioned, like using Swift UI for the UI part while using a game engine that I'm very familiar with because I wrote it, also lets me be very productive and move very quickly as well.
Now, speaking of your game engine, can you explain to me and our listeners what part of the game is being done in Swift UI and what's being done using Imagine Engine? So what's the split there?
Sure. So the split is pretty much that if it's a UI component that kind of is rendered on top of the game, so it's almost like an overlay, then it's rendered using Swift UI. And if it's part of the game itself, like if it's part of the map, and we can put a link in the show notes to a screenshot, and perhaps Rambo can put another chapter art screenshot as well in here so you can see what it looks like. That is all rendered using Imagine Engine, the game itself. And Imagine Engine is in turn a kind of game-specific abstraction layer on top of core animation. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really doing any like rendering myself. I'm just leveraging core animation for that. And that has proven to be such a good choice in general, where I am kind of aligning my technologies with Apple's technologies, mm-hmm. where all of the optimizations that they've been doing for iOS, for macOS, for tvOS, I can leverage all of those optimizations with core animation that renders out of process. It does a lot of work on the GPU. So even like in a really busy scene, like I've added, I think, close to 1,000 objects now to the game scene. And it all just renders with like 2% CPU, 60 frames per second, not a single frame dropped. And it's all thanks to kind of like having that really efficient rendering pipeline using core animation.
Yeah, now correct me if I'm wrong here, but your game graphics are mainly bitmap textures, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So yeah, they are mostly PNGs, but for some of the opaque textures, we use JPEGs.
Yeah. Yeah, so I suspect, and I could definitely be wrong here, but from the profiling you sent me, I would guess that the overhead of using core animation for something like that isn't that much larger than going like full metal, like using metal directly, because it's basically, it's just, John, so easy. It's just taking your bitmap textures and shoving them into the GPU, basically. So it right. is, of course, there is some overhead, but it is quite small. And that's been my experience with core animations for a while, since I started using it more heavily with Chibi Studio back in 2016. It is quite a high-level abstraction. It has some niceties of a high-level framework and API. It's not actually a framework, but you know what I mean. But at the same time, it is this thin wrapper around what you can do with the rendering system on Apple's platforms.
Absolutely. And I've always said that the reason that I picked core animation, besides, you know, wanting to align my interests with Apple's interests, which is something that I'm always looking to do when I pick technologies, is that the optimizations that Apple have made to core animation are probably better than the optimizations that I would be able to make on my own if I were to use Metal directly. So like you're saying, it's a very thin abstraction. It doesn't really, you know, hurt performance, and it's really, really efficient. And it can also perform like a lot of smart optimizations when it comes to how it draws the graphics, how it caches those, how it reuses the results, and so on. So I could have, you know, I know how to write a shader, so I could have like written a simple pixel shader that just like draws out the graphics, but I'm not sure. Maybe I will try that again at some point just for fun, but core animation is really performing super well in this scenario.
Yeah, and speaking of knowing how to write a shader, which I have done in the past, it's not that hard. I actually want to recommend here that every iOS or Mac developer out there look at like the basic tutorials of how you can get a metal setup up and running, and also how to write core image kernels using Metal. It's really cool. And it's not as hard as you'd think, because when you're working on that abstraction that's a shader, you basically have to make it work for one pixel at a time. And that's it.
Yeah.
So if you can make your algorithm work with one pixel, you can make it work. Of course, it's not that simple, but in general, for the things you'll be doing, it's basically that. And it's quite fun. I enjoy it. And also, core animation is super cool because not only is it an abstraction and it's super performant in most cases, but it also offers a huge range of things you can do with it, such as working with paths and strokes and shadows. And you can even add core image filters to your core animation scenes or layers. So that's really cool. And you can also render car animation layers into video using AV Foundation. So I think it's super cool how all of these technologies come together. If you've ever wondered how FusionCast works, it's all core animation that's rendered into a video using AV Foundation. So yeah, it's super powerful.
Yeah, it really is. And it's even got like a particle effect system. Like yeah. There's all sorts of things in there, which is really cool. And I really do think that core animation is kind of like the secret hero of Apple's platforms in general. Mm-hmm. Like there is no way that the original iPhone would have been so performant and so like working so well in terms of the multi-touch user interface and everything without core animation. And there's no coincidence that that's when core animation was introduced to make those interfaces happen. And that's the cool thing. Like core animation, of course, they have optimized it and improved it over the years since, but the fundamentals remain the same. And since it was optimized for such a low power device as the original iPhone was, then, you know, it's no wonder that it works so well now with these modern capable devices we have, where, you know, you can render 120 frames per second on the new iPad Pros. Well, they're not so new anymore, but you know, the iPad Pros with the 120 hertz refresh rate, and it just works. Like, that's why I love core animation so much. It's like, it doesn't let me down. It doesn't just like change 1 year and everything breaks. Like, it's been rock solid since the original iPhone, which is just so great.
Yeah, definitely. Now, you've been working on this game, and something that comes up a lot when we're developing new apps, and also comes up a lot with games because it's a different type of development, is the architecture aspect. What are you doing for this particular project in terms of architecture?
So I think this is a pretty interesting case, and I think the architecture that I've ended up using is not so much game specific. I think it can be applicable to a lot of different apps that want to interact between Swift UI and some other rendering tool. So the way I'm doing it is that, like we just talked about, I'm using Swift UI for the UI overlays, and then I'm using Imagine Engine, which is using core animation, as the game engine itself. But I need a way to communicate between those, because the UI state needs to reflect the game state, and when something happens in the UI, then the game needs to be updated, right? So there needs to be some kind of connection point there.
If only there was an API that will let you combine stuff.
Right, exactly. That would be useful. So that might sound like an edge case. Like, okay, I'm building a game with Swift UI as the UI. That's probably not extremely common, although I've heard from a few other people who are doing something similar, but it's not super common in the grand scheme of things. But I think it's common in general, like, to have those two interconnected parts. For example, you might have some kind of canvas view that you want to communicate between with Swift UI, maybe something you will encounter in Chibi Studio, in fact, Rambo, mm-hmm. as you might start adopting Swift UI more. Or if you have something like a map view, maybe, or some kind of video view, like anything where you need to render something a bit more custom and you want to communicate with Swift UI between those two things, I think this kind of pattern will emerge. So the way I chose to abstract this, or to kind of model this architecturally, was to actually just use MVC. Just use MVC,
oh, wow.
Rambo.
Surprise.
So normally when I use Swift UI, I tend to lean more into kind of an MVVM style approach, where the view model abstraction works so well with Swift UI, where you can include all of your view specific logic inside of your view model, and then you can have your view model expose bindings, and it can be an observable object, and then the view just re-renders automatically. You don't have to write any state management code. Well, in this case, since I needed also that view model or that entity to also control the game itself, I felt like it was more appropriate. I just said the word there even, right? Mm-hmm. It was more appropriate for it to be a controller. So the way I've chosen it, to model this is that I have a controller, a game controller, that is nothing to do with Swift UI, and it has nothing to do with the game. And then it controls the Swift UI view hierarchy, and it communicates between those two with protocols. So there's no kind of direct relationship there. And the same thing also with the Imagine Engine scene. So that way, I have a pretty neat abstraction where the game logic can live inside of the controller. And in fact, that's implemented completely cross-platform. So I've actually put all of that code in a Swift package. So that Swift package is cross-platform, and then there's nothing there with Swift UI or UIKit or Imagine Engine or anything like that. And then the game rendering code is in its own Swift package, using Imagine Engine as a dependency. And then the Swift UI part is a third package where it depends on Swift UI. And then I have the app-specific layers for the Mac and for iOS, which is using UIKit and AppKit, respectively. So I think this has been a pretty sweet approach where when something happens in the UI, the Swift UI view can trigger a binding, which then gets connected to the controller. And then the controller can do its logic and it can tell the game scene, again, through a protocol, what happened, right? How to update the game state. And that way I have to write very, very minimal kind of bookkeeping code in order to make sure that these two things stay in sync because it all goes through those events. And then the final part of the puzzle is that I have a lot of, you know, actual logic and algorithms and things like that to compute like pathfinding and connect all the terrain and things like that. And that's all done in like value types with pure functions. So I just say like find a path from here to here and I get returned an array of paths, for example. So that's also very testable and I don't need to connect that to any specific like domain. I can have that live outside of the controllers and just call those functions whenever I need those.
That's beautiful. I love it.
Yeah, and it kind of goes in line with my general way of architecting apps, which is that I like to start with MVC as the starting point. And then I might add things like view models, like I just mentioned, if I'm using Swift UI in a more kind of traditional app context. I might add things like coordinators if I feel like the app that I'm working on has that kind of flow where I want to go through those linear flows with coordinators. Or I might add some other abstraction that is appropriate for the thing I'm trying to build, but I don't like to add unnecessary abstractions unless it's needed. So that's why I always like to start with, I have models, I have views, and I have controllers, and then I can just add whatever I need whenever I need it.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I also do something very similar. Yeah, that's really cool. I'm looking forward to playing the game.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to putting it on test flight as soon as possible. I mean, if I'm continuing to make this kind of progress, which I'm not thinking that I will continue to be able to be so productive. I mean, eventually I might not, but I'm hoping to be able to put it on test flight as soon as possible.
Awesome.
But that's been a long John's Game Development Corner edition here on this episode. So now, Rambo, I want to hear what you've been up to. I hear that you are about to start a beta of your own, maybe.
Well, AirBuddy 2 is close to being beta testable. So what that basically means is it doesn't crash very often. There aren't empty screens or placeholder content anywhere. I think that's a good place. That's my particular choice for a beta stage. But yeah, and I'm actually kidding. It's quite advanced. The thing is that I was mostly focusing on getting the basics perfect, and perfect in quotes here because nothing is perfect, but I was really focusing on getting all of the basic functionality to be as rock solid as possible. And now I'm in that stage where I'm like adding the little things and the little touches and doing like the more user-facing cool stuff.
That's super cool. It's also what I feel like when you reach that phase where you find yourself like polishing all these details, then it's probably time to start the beta, right? Mm-hmm. Because when you start the beta, you will also get feedback, usage, crash reports, things like that, which also help you further polish and shape things before you ship them.
Yeah. And speaking about feedback, I'm actually developing, it's one of my things that I on my checklist before the beta, that I need to have this for the beta. I'm actually, for the first time in AirBuddy, developing an in-app feedback system. So I'm basically creating my own radar.
That's super cool. I wanted to ask you this when you brought it up with me a few days ago, but I'm going to ask you here on air now, and I'm sorry for like putting you on the spot, but is this something that you feel could be like made into something like a general purpose tool that people could use either as an open source project or something else?
I think so. This is very Mac specific as it is right now. But it is actually abstracted away from the app itself, so it's not something that's completely tied into the app. And I am doing it in a way that has some protocols in there and some things that can be changed later, so this could eventually end up becoming a Swift package or something, but I'm not promising anything here. And the backend for this, I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it, but I decided to write a simple backend that famous last words, simple backend. But it's using Cloudflare Workers, of course. Again, not a sponsor again, but I am doing it because it's so easy to just use their tool and generate a new endpoint and just start writing the code. So just write the code, right, John? It's just so easy.
Yeah, exactly. But it literally is in the case of Cloudflare Workers, actually, where you can just like click like new worker and then you get an online editor like in the browser and you can just write JavaScript in there and you just click deploy and it's deployed. Like, it is pretty crazy and cool just like how easy it is now to get these cloud functions up and running. And again, this is something where there are other providers as well, and I'm sure that they have similar workflows. It's just that we are mostly familiar with Cloudflare Workers. Yeah. But I do love that about this kind of serverless movement, like we talked about on the previous episode, just how much it just removes all the friction to just trying out a new idea.
Yeah, and this is a pretty simple backend, like I mentioned. I was kidding about the just do it, but it is quite a simple backend. So my initial idea was to have this thing that would collect diagnosis information and then basically just create a new email message within mail with my support email as the recipient. But, you know, then it starts becoming a problem because the person needs to have an email account configured on their Mac and it might not be there. And then maybe the attachment is a little bit too large and it's not going to go through. So I decided to make a simple backend that's going to receive the information sent from the app. And then inside of this worker that I'm writing, it is going to notify me over email about these reports. So it's basically, in the end, it is email, but it's abstracted away from the user.
That sounds really nice. One huge benefit of doing something like that as well, I think, is that you can control the fields, right, that needs to be mm-hmm. filled in, and you can automatically attach like any diagnostics and things like that you need, because that's such a common thing. Like when you just have an email address that different people go into different amounts of details. Some people go into too many details. Some people don't provide any details at all. They just email you saying, this is broken, right?
Yeah.
And then you're like, well, thanks for the bug report. So I think it's really nice to have like fields that need to be filled in, and then you can also get something in a more kind of uniformed way where it's going to be easier for you also to filter through it. You don't have to like read N amount of emails that are formatted in N amount of ways, but you get something in a more uniform fashion.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am actually doing quite a guided thing, similar to Apple feedback, where you select like, is this a bug report? Is this a general feature request? Or is this something to do with your license? So there is an entire flow that the user goes through. And depending on what they select, like if it's a bug report, it is going to collect diagnostics automatically. And I even have like a thing where if it is reproducible, I ask the user to reproduce the issue while the feedback capturing tool is running, so that it will capture any logs related to the issue. So it is quite cool, I think, the way I'm doing it. And it's also nice that this won't require the user to go like, oh, what's the model of my Mac? What's the version of macOS? It just goes automatically with the submission.
That sounds really awesome. So if people now want to find out more about the AirBuddy beta, like do you have some kind of sign up flow already up, or should they just watch your Twitter, or how are you planning to roll this out?
You know, that's another thing I should write a simple backend for, like an official beta process. But as of right now, I don't have anything, but of course, follow me on Twitter. And
keep listening to Stacktrace, right?
Yeah, of course. And then you're going to see me tweet about it. And also AirBuddy, the app itself, has a Twitter account at AirBuddyApp. So you can follow it there. It's going to be tweeted in that account as well.
Nice. I'm really looking forward to trying the beta. I know some of the things that you've been working on. I don't want to reveal them, of course. No spoilers. But I think it's going to be pretty great.
Yeah, the beta won't have the new icon, by the way, which is a secret. It's
that's cool.
Doubling all down right. on secrecy, John. I think you are one of three people who have seen the new icon. So
all right.
It's a very exclusive club. If it leaks, I know who it was.
Did you put like a little watermark on the icon you sent me? So if I did leak it, you knew it was me?
Yeah, I did.
And you're not going to include those icons in the bundle with underscore underscore hide, right?
Well, now that you mentioned it, I should probably make sure they're not in there.
They might. Wouldn't it be funny if like Apple went in there, you know, downloaded your app and spelunked your app and revealed the icon just as, you know, payback for what you've done?
Well, it would be fair.
All right. So now let's move on to our In the News segment. But before we do, let's take a very quick break and thank this episode's sponsor. This week's episode of Stack Trace is brought to you by iMazing, the most popular all-purpose iPhone and iPad manager for your Mac and PC. Head over to iMazing.com/stacktrace to learn more and to get a 30% discount on your license. With iMazing, you can make Time Machine-style scheduled backups of your iOS devices to your own storage over either USB or Wi-Fi. Once you have a local backup, you can then browse files, photos, contacts, notes, calendars, and more straight from any backup snapshot and recover just what you need. Backups can and should be encrypted and are 100% compatible with iTunes and Finder backups. And for developers, iMazing's file browser is a great way to get precious insights into how iOS's file system is structured without having to jailbreak your device. It lets you understand what part of your app's data gets backed up and how, and what kind of data the third-party SDK store, and it also lets you test various scenarios by populating your app's library and documents folder with test files. In fact, Rambo, you talked a little bit about this on the previous episode, but that's something that you've been using iMazing for yourself, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I really like using it to do development work, not only do backups and things like that, which is also super useful, and I do like to do sometimes. As you know, I like to change iPhones fairly frequently. So,
yeah,
when you do that, if you have a backup that's done using iMazing, which is the same basically as backing it up on iTunes or Finder, just with a better user interface, you can encrypt the backup and it will back up more things than if you just did the iCloud backup. So I always prefer that method. And it's always way faster to restore the backup after you've done it. And also for the developer stuff, you can replace your app's container on the fly. And I've been using that for marketing. So when I am preparing to do my marketing screenshots, I have this pre-made app bundle with all of this demo data inside of it that I replace using iMazing. And it's quite amazing.
Yeah, hence the name, right?
Yeah.
iMazing is also made by a team of passionate Mac developers, and it shows. It's already updated for macOS Big Sur, and they also quickly add support for all of the latest iOS betas. iOS 14, for instance, is already fully supported. You also get lots of other development features, like a device console, you get access to device log files, the ability to reinstall iOS without erasing it, so much more. So head over to iMazing.com/stacktrace to try iMazing for free right now. And by using that specific link, you not only directly help support me and Rambo and Stacktrace and ensure that the episodes keep coming, but you will also get a 30% discount on your iMazing license as well. And this offer is valid until iOS 14 gets publicly released. So you don't have that many weeks, so I would suggest to check it out right now. Once again, that's iMazing.com/stacktrace. Thanks a lot to iMazing for sponsoring this episode of Stacktrace. All right, Rambo, so now it's time for our In the News segment, and we have yet another App Store story this week. It feels almost like, you know, how Apple, they have some kind of App Store scandal every week. What is going on right now, Rambo?
Well, I first would like for you to explain to me, because I do have an idea of what it is, But what exactly is Microsoft xCloud?
All right. So xCloud, not to be confused with Xcode
or iCloud,
right? So xCloud is a new game streaming service that Microsoft have been building, and it's connected to their Game Pass service. So on the Xbox, the game console Xbox, Microsoft, they have this service called Game Pass where you can subscribe and you get to play all of the games that are included in that bundle whenever you want. So it's kind of like Apple Arcade. You pay a monthly fee and then you get access to the games. But so far, you've downloaded those games to your Xbox. So exactly like Apple Arcade. You download the games, you can play them, and for as long as you have your subscription, right? And Microsoft have made a pretty big deal about Game Pass recently where all of the first-party games that they develop themselves or together with their studios that they're partnering with, they go directly into this Game Pass service on day one, which has been a pretty big deal in the game industry in general, where the PlayStation equivalent, PlayStation Plus, you get like free, or not free because you pay for it, but you get games that are included every month, but those are like two games per month and they're typically not the latest titles. So this is a pretty interesting service, I think, from Microsoft. And the xCloud part of that is that now you'll be able to stream those games directly from the cloud onto various devices. So you don't need an Xbox to play these Xbox games. And there's a lot of really cool games in there. And I've been personally really looking forward to trying this out because I don't have an Xbox One, the latest Xbox version. I did have an Xbox 360, but I've been looking forward to playing a lot of these games that I haven't yet been playing, like the new Halo games and lots of other stuff. So I was really looking forward to seeing this appear on iOS so that you'll be able to play Xbox games using xCloud over the cloud on your iPhone. But it looks like that might not be happening. Or what do you say, Rambo?
So another question. Does the game run on the actual device, or is it like running on a remote server and you only see the pixels on your device?
It's running on a remote server. So just like Google Stadia and other services before it, like OnLive. Did you ever use OnLive, Rambo?
No, I've never used any of these streaming gaming things.
So OnLive came out, I want to say almost like 10, 15 years ago or something. Wow. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but it was a long time ago. I remember like playing it on my, I want to say like my iBook or my like first MacBook Pro. And it was a cloud game streaming service. Of course, the latency was pretty large and the quality was not the best, the image quality, but it was amazing. Like they had this user interface where you got put into this grid of games and you at the beginning, it looked like videos. Like, oh, there are all these videos playing around the grid.
Yeah.
But then you discover that those are actually games that you can just like navigate with a keyboard and press enter and you jump into the game and you can just start playing. Like it was pretty mind-blowing when that came out. And I still think that the idea of cloud-based gaming is really interesting. Like not having to be in front of your TV with a powerful console, but instead have that console in a data center somewhere and you can connect to it over the internet. So that's what xCloud is, and that's what Google Stadia is as well. Of course, there is some logic being executed on the device to read like the game controller and to, you know, send data upwards and download new image data and display it. But in general, you can kind of look at it as a very thin client that is just communicating with a cloud service.
Yeah, so technically it will be kind of like an interactive film or something, but you're interacting with it every millisecond, basically.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and of course, this is not being allowed in the App Store, and that's where we get to our story here. And as far as I've read, basically Apple is saying that they can't allow this in the App Store because they can't review each game that's going to be available. Is that right?
Yeah, so that's kind of the statement that Apple has been giving. They gave it to Business Insider, I believe, the statement. And Microsoft have also been giving some statements around this as well. And this is all kind of playing out now as we speak. So things might change after this recording. But so far, it looks like Apple's stance is that, yeah, they want all the games to be submitted individually. So basically, like, each game should have its own app. It shouldn't be one app called xCloud, and then you can just play any number of games within that app. It should be each game has its own individual app. And as well, the App Store guidelines do actually explicitly kind of forbid these things. Mm-hmm. It even says in section 427 that thin clients for cloud-based apps are not appropriate for the App Store. Which, you know, it's interesting when you look at kind of, you know, FTP clients and all sorts of services that lets you use remote desktop.
Web browsers.
Yeah, of course. I mean, this is all tricky situations, right? And you can interpret it either way. But that's the stance that Apple have been taking. And then, of course, Microsoft were not very happy about this. So they also gave a statement around that, you know, the iOS platform is the only kind of general purpose computing platform that is not allowing cloud gaming. So yeah. I have a take on this, which I don't think I've heard anyone else say so far. And I've been trying to follow as much of this coverage as possible. And of course, someone might have already made this take, but I want to hear first, before I give my kind of view on this, I want to hear, what's your take on this, Rambo?
I want to give a more generalized take on not the issue itself necessarily, but more in terms of reactions to... I want to do a take on the other takes.
Oh, a meta take. I love it.
A meta take. It's interesting to see how many people jump into defending Apple in these situations with basically just stating that, oh, they read the guidelines, it's in the guidelines, you can't do it, that's it. Like, I've seen many people take that position. And at the same time, you can say, yeah, it's in the guidelines, but we don't agree with the guidelines. But while these are the guidelines, then they should be following it. That's also a similar take, a little bit less aggressive in that direction, but it's still a take. And my take is, it's our responsibility to not follow guidelines which are unfair and with which we disagree with. That's Rambo the Rebel right there. So
yeah.
I don't agree that just because something is a guideline, and we're not talking about the Constitution or a law here, we're talking about a guideline from Apple. And these are all very blurry. Some of them are, you like we mentioned, of the thin clients, you can interpret in multiple ways. So I think if you're a company or a developer and you're doing something, you're developing something in good faith, and it goes against the guidelines because of some technicality like this, you should try and get it in the App Store. And a company that recently did this was, and today they announced it, is SetApp. So SetApp actually released SetApp for iOS, and the way it works, as I understand it, is they give you like a code that you can use to unlock your subscription in the supported apps, and of course you paid for that through SetApp, through their website or on your Mac, and this is also explicitly forbidden by the App Store guidelines. I think they actually mention you can't use QR codes, license keys, to unlock functionality, but somehow it got approved and it's working. And I don't think people should be pointing the finger at SetApp for violating a guideline that's unfair. I think we should praise them for having the hashtag courage to break the guidelines in this case. And yeah, it will probably end up being another issue. Apple is probably rejecting their update as we speak right now, and it's going to be yet another story. So yeah, that's my overall take on this.
Yeah, and I do agree with you that the guidelines are not also set in stone. They change all the time. I think it's even in the guidelines that the guidelines will change, right? I mean, that's typically how you structure these things, right? You always put a paragraph that says, we can change this at any time. Sorry, yeah. Right? but that's really true. I mean, because people come up with new ideas, there are new business models being invented, there are new app ideas being invented all the time. So the guidelines can't cover everything. And sometimes also it's good, like you're saying, to kind of put some pressure on Apple to also evolve the platform. Because I don't think anyone, and I'm not saying Apple wants this either, but no one wants iOS as a platform to stand still, right?
Yeah.
We want it to continue to evolve and grow. And sometimes that will cause a little friction when someone tries something that maybe Apple doesn't like, or they don't agree with, or something they haven't considered in the guidelines, etc. So this type of friction will probably keep happening as long as there are App Store guidelines to break.
Yeah.
But I also agree that I don't think anyone should be too quick to kind of jump into like an extreme camp, either like Apple is doing everything right and never does anything wrong, and that, you know, the other camp, which is Apple, is always doing something wrong. I mean, all of these things are extremely tricky. And, you know, I also sympathize with Apple having to write guidelines for millions of apps, right? Like, there are so many edge cases.
I don't envy that position at all.
I don't envy that position either. But of course, it's a position they've put themselves in as well, right? So it's a very complicated matter. And I think, you know, my opinion tends to sway back and forth on this, depending on the case, depending on, you know, the time. I sometimes lean more to agreeing with Apple, sometimes I don't. In this case also, I'm also really interested in seeing this service appear on iOS, so I might be a little bit biased in that case, right?
And I want to add something here with regards to, you mentioned pressure, and we know that Apple puts pressure on other companies and developers in ways that can be questionable sometimes. And we have documents with evidence of that. So why is it unfair for developers to put pressure on Apple for change? And one of the ways we can put pressure on Apple is by going against the guidelines and doing things such as what SetApp is doing and what Hey did, which causes a public issue to come to the awareness of the public. And that can be a big way to put pressure for things to change. If we just sit here and complain, nothing's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's really important to have that kind of negotiation, if you will, happening between the wider community and Apple, so that it's not just Apple sets the rules and then everyone else better just follow them or get out, right? Because that way you're going to have a very unbalanced relationship, which, you know, you can already argue that the relationship is unbalanced with Apple having most of the power.
Yep.
But, you know, yeah, it goes back and forth and depends on what your viewpoint is. But there's been a lot of talk about why Apple has this strong stance here in this case. Like, of course, it's in the guidelines that they don't allow cloud streaming apps like this. There's also other points in the guideline, and we could put a link in the show notes to the guidelines, but there's also other points in the guidelines around explicitly allowing these types of apps, clients, when they are streaming from a device that is on your own network, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why you have something like the PlayStation app, for example. It lets me stream my PlayStation 4 to my iPad, which is really cool, but only like through my own network, right? So it's not going through Sony's PlayStation servers like the xCloud app is doing with Microsoft servers.
Yep.
But I do have another take on why, because the whys that I've heard so far are either that it's A, about money, that they want to have the 30% cut on all the subscriptions. It might be B, that they are using this as a negotiation tactic, that they want Microsoft to do something else for Apple before they allow this.
Yeah.
But I have an option C here, Rambo. Do you want to hear it?
Of course. Let's hear it.
So I call this Apple, Microsoft, and the Pandora's Box of Software Streaming. I even gave it a nice title.
Wow.
So I think that there's a fair chance that Apple looks at this as sort of like, if they allow this to go through and they allow game streaming services on the App Store, which are essentially streaming software from outside of the device, that they look at that a little bit like opening Pandora's box, where in order for Apple to have control over the App Store, which they want to have, I mean, that's very clear, they need to review the apps, like we mentioned earlier. But the apps also need to be executing locally on the device, because we can imagine a future not too far from now, and some people could even argue that the future is already here, where the experience of running a piece of software remotely on a server and stream the image and stream the result back to the device could be as good or at least comparable to running software locally. And I think that Apple is a little bit scared of this. Like, if they would allow this to go through, what's to stop someone from making like an Android client for iOS or like a Windows client or whatever, like anything you can imagine, or software that Apple doesn't want on the App Store, right? To make like a Las Vegas app, which just streams all these forbidden apps into the phone, right? I think that that is the primary reason, or that's, I mean, I don't have any insider information, but I think that is a very, very strong reason for Apple not to allow this.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. But at the same time, like, why? I mean, what's the problem if someone wants to run an Android client on their iPhone? It's their problem, not Apple's. I don't see why they have to be so stingy about it.
I do agree with you. And again, I'd really hope that this will actually be allowed, because I want to see not necessarily the Android client, but I do want to see xCloud. But I do think that is a very, very big concern for Apple. Like, if I was to put myself in Apple's shoes and I want to maintain the control of the App Store, I would be pretty scared to, you know, to think about a future where maybe a larger part of the software that is available is streamed this way. It's again, not that hard to imagine, given like the internet connectivity speeds, given how things are evolving. So I do also see it from the Apple side of maybe being a little bit, you know, cautious here.
There's another solution which will allow them to keep the control of the App Store the same as they have today and allow this type of stuff to happen, which is sideloading.
Yeah.
The Mac has sideloading. You can run any app on your Mac and it's fine. The world hasn't ended. people aren't dying because they can run an app from outside the Mac App Store. I think that's going to end up being the solution.
Yeah, I also think that could be a way out of this. Or treating it kind of like CarPlay, right? Where I don't see a lot of people being super upset about how Apple deals with CarPlay, where it is a very special club that you need to apply to be in order to get that entitlement to be able to run your app on CarPlay. So maybe they could do something similar here and say, like, we don't want to allow any streaming service, like any software streaming service, because we feel like that's too dangerous, or that could just open up for anybody circumventing the whole App Store in ways we don't want. I'm now speaking on behalf of Apple imaginatively, right? but they could give that entitlement to Microsoft, say, hey, we trust Microsoft. Here is your entitlement for the streaming software.
Yeah, and they don't do it just for CarPlay. There are lots of things they do it for. There is this critical alert entitlement that some apps can have, which allows the app to send you alerts and bypass Do Not Disturb, which is important for certain types of apps, like medication reminding apps and things like that. There is this new one for default apps. So if you are a web browser, there are these regulations you need to follow of what constitutes a web browser so that you can apply for the default web browser entitlement. Same goes for default email app. And there are lots of other entitlements and even some private ones they give to specific developers that basically there is no form on Apple's website for you to apply. You have to basically be invited into the secret club of entitlements.
But Rambo, they treat all developers the same. That's what Tim Cook said, right?
Yeah, exactly. And we're basically arguing that they should treat developers less the same that they're doing now. And I would be fine with that if the reason for that would be to give the other developers more freedom to do some things, but not open up that possibility to everyone, which I agree is not feasible. Like you mentioned, it is a Pandora's box. So like if they added a new critical alert thing and didn't have the special entitlement requirement, you'd have like e-commerce apps sending you critical alerts of their new discounts on underwear or something.
Right, exactly. So yeah, I think we agree on that as well. And it's a tricky situation, but I hope that they'll get resolved and, you know, either through an entitlement or through allowing sideloading or something else, because I think this will just keep happening. Like, it feels like it's happening more and more, these kind of big clashes between Apple and different companies that get really public big stories. And I just hope that we can find some kind of way collectively, us and Apple and everybody, to kind of agree on this or to find a way forward.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So speaking of finding a way forward, someone who has taken a step forward is Phil Schiller. Speaking about the App Store, Phil Schiller has taken on a new title at Apple called Apple Fellow. So he's no longer the Senior Vice President of Worldwide Marketing, I believe was his title before. So Rambo, what's your take on this? Like if Phil, should we say stepping down, moving ahead? What's going on here, you think?
Moving sideways.
Exactly.
Doing some weird things. I don't know. I think, so Phil had many roles. He was head of marketing. He also ran PR for a while, I think a few months, maybe close to a year. He was running PR and also running the App Store and Apple events. So that's a lot of stuff. And apparently, Phil wants more time with his family, and that's normal. Like, he's been doing this for a long time. It's perfectly acceptable to want to have more time for himself and his family. So he's moving away from some of these roles, but apparently he's gonna keep control of App Store and of Apple events, but the other stuff he is giving away. So yeah, that's very interesting. There have been some people speculating about this being like a punishment for recent events regarding the App Store. I could see that, but I think it's something that's been planned for a while and it just happened to occur right now. I think it's mainly a coincidence. So yeah, and I think it is healthy for Apple and for everyone that the same person is not running everything like he was doing. Like, he was running both App Store and PR. And recently, there's been a lot of issues with App Store and PR. So maybe having the same person running PR and the thing that's having PR issues can be an issue. Like, maybe someone else at the company would have responded better to the whole Hey PR scandal, because there were some really inflammatory quotes from Apple PR regarding the Hey thing, and from Phil Schiller personally, I mean professionally, I guess. So yeah, I think this is going to be a good thing in the long term.
Yeah, and it's also always healthy to occasionally get some new people into an organization as well. Like, if you have the same people in charge, and like you also said, in charge of so much, it not only prevents people in the organization from advancing, right? Like, they get stuck in some kind of position. Or it can also just lead to kind of recycling ideas or getting stuck in the past. I'm not saying that this is what happened with Phil in charge. I think Phil has done so many great things for Apple. And especially since he took over the App Store, I think it has improved. And maybe it hasn't improved to the extent that we wish. And there are still a lot of things to resolve, like we talked about. But I still think, you know, he's been really good at what he's been doing. But also, like, a huge amount of different tasks for one person to have. I think just running the App Store is probably like a full-time job in of itself.
Yeah, even more than a full-time job, probably.
Exactly.
Yeah, and to be fair, he improved the App Store quite a bit since he joined, especially the developer experience. We complain a lot about App Store Connect and things like that, but and of course, there are ways it could improve a lot, but it used to take a week for an app to be reviewed, and shortly after Phil joined the App Store and started running it, we saw that drop to like a day or two tops. So that, just for that, I thank him for his role in the App Store.
Yeah, and that's also important to point out, like, the App Store has its issues, and we're always kind of like complaining a little bit about it or pointing out issues whenever they occur, because that's how we improve also, right? Yep. But the App Store has also improved a lot. Like, I think we just talked about it on the previous episode where I mentioned that when I was doing freelancing, like, you know, in 2010, 2011, I was like budgeting like a month and a half for app review, right? Yeah. Like, that's not something you really have to do as much anymore. So it has definitely improved, but yeah. Hopefully it can improve even further. And yeah, hopefully Phil will have a good time as his new role as an Apple fellow.
Absolutely.
Cool. So since we went into such a deep dive, both in the beginning of this episode around game development and also around the issues around the App Store, we're not going to do a deep dive segment on this episode. We're going to save that for the next one, but we are going to do some follow-up, if you will. We don't typically do follow-up, but we have a little bit here from Alexander as part of our Ask Stacktrace segment. So Alexander asked us a question, which is, he said that we did a great deep dive into Async Await, so thanks a lot for that. That was like two episodes ago. But he does have a follow-up question, and he asks, do you think that it would be beneficial if Swift would allow you to define your own keywords as part of a framework so that Async Await could potentially be implemented in a separate package and shipped much quicker? So essentially, as third-party developers, should we be able to define our own Swift keywords and our own kind of compile time processing? What do you think, Rambo?
Wow, that's tricky. I'm thinking about it here, and to me, it's a little bit, and of course, this is 100% personal, and I'm not saying that it should or shouldn't be a particular way, but I, for instance, refrain from using packages, frameworks, CocoaPods, whatever, which have custom operators, because I don't really like the look of them. And I think it deviates too much from vanilla. And as you know, my favorite flavor is vanilla.
right.
So, yeah, I'm not a fan of that. So I think my opinion on custom keywords would be similar or the same. But that's, again, just looking at this from the perspective of someone who eventually uses other people's code and packages, I would probably be wary of using a package with custom keywords. I think it can become a little bit of a problem if it starts adding up. But I want to hear your opinion.
So before I give you my opinion on this, I wanted to just ask you a follow-up question, which is, Swift is kind of moving towards custom keywords in some cases with function builders, property wrappers, and so on, where you can annotate certain things like functions or properties with this at something, and it will resolve into your own type, and it will then execute your own custom logic. So how do you feel about that in relation to kind of completely custom keywords? Do you feel like that's kind of on the spectrum towards custom keywords, or, you know, do you feel that it's a separate thing completely?
It definitely goes a little bit in that direction, but I feel like just having the at sign in front of things is already a huge thing, because it makes it clear that it's a property wrapper. I think having a clear distinction between what's a keyword and what's something else that someone else is providing for you, or maybe it's the standard library, but I think it's beneficial to differentiate between the things. So but at the same time, I am not using third-party code that implements custom property wrappers right now. And it is something that I think hard about before adopting from third parties, because I feel like it's so easy to use, but at the same time, it's such a powerful thing that if there are issues with the thing you're using, it can be a big problem for you. So yeah, I think it is in the spectrum, like you mentioned. But I think just having the at sign is a good thing.
So what if you would be able to define your own custom keywords, but they would need to use the at sign? So you could do something like, you could declare a struct somewhere that is a keyword, and then you can just use at somewhere and it would map to that keyword and perform some kind of processing. Would you be okay with that, or would it still be a step too far in your opinion?
I think it would be better than just plain keywords, but I probably wouldn't use it anyway.
Right.
Just as I don't use custom operators. I don't know, it's just something that I feel like it's making my code dirty, John.
Yeah, and you want your code to be clean. You don't want to have to wash it every time, right? So yeah. I have a final question for you, Rambo. Sorry, I'm interrogating you here.
It's the follow-up within the follow-up within the follow-up.
Exactly. How do you feel about C-style macros? Like in C languages, like Objective-C, you can write macros, which is essentially doing string replacement on your source code. So you could write a macro that takes something and then manipulates that code somehow to wrap it in some kind of object or something, and then that is what actually gets compiled. How do you feel about those kind of macros?
Oh, I love them. No, I'm kidding. I see where they can be useful, and I've had instances where I wanted something similar in Swift, but it wasn't there. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it can also become unwieldy with time. So I think it should also be used sparingly, only like in very specific instances. And I guess my opinion is the same on the property wrappers and the keywords and custom operators thing. I think it's something that should be used extremely sparingly.
Yeah. So the reason I asked you all of these questions and did this interrogation is kind of to frame my opinion on all of this, where, so like I mentioned, Swift has been adding a lot of kind of compile time customization options over time. And you could start even with something like Codable, where if you annotate a struct with Codable, it gets automatic JSON encoding and decoding support, or also to other formats as well, right? So that is another example of the compiler generating code on your behalf by you annotating it with something. And the same thing is true for property wrappers, for function builders, which both play a huge part of Swift UI, but they are also features that we can use. Function builders hasn't gone through Swift Evolution yet, so it still has an underscore in front of the keyword. So it's questionable whether you should rely on it or not, but they are still all like in the language, right? Yeah. My opinion is that rather than doing these one-off things and to keep doing them, I would rather see Swift adopt a kind of Rust style macro system. So Rust has macros, just like C and Objective-C and other C-based languages do, but they're way safer and they act kind of like metaprogramming. So you can write in Rust, in the Rust programming language, you can write a function that essentially transforms your source code in a more type-safe way. So you can write compile time logic that gets executed when your app is being compiled, and you can do different things with it. So here you could use it for things like in Objective-C, you would sometimes do method swizzling, right? At runtime, you would change the implementation of methods. Mm-hmm. Well, with something like a macro system, you can do all that stuff at compile time. So it's way safer and it doesn't require any runtime logic to be executed. And I would love to see things like Codable, property wrappers, function builders, all of these kind of custom compile time attributes to instead be macros so that it could be a general purpose system that anybody could use. And if someone wanted to implement something like async await or something else like futures and promises or some other type of compile time code generation style of logic, they can do it using one single kind of uniform system. And the benefit of that, I mean, you could see that as like, speaking of Pandora's box, right? That could lead to a lot of different code styles, and you might not recognize Swift code anymore because some people are using these macros and other people are using these macros and it becomes a mess. But at the same time, like, we are kind of already there with all of these attributes and things like that. And I think if a language feature can be abused and misused, I don't think that's a reason to not do it. I think if you need it to be there and you need to use that kind of logic, then why not just build it properly, right? Why not just build it properly? I think that would be really cool to see in something like Swift, like a macro system.
Yeah, it just scares me a little bit. I think it's fascinating how in the same episode, I was Rambo the Rebel and an old man yelling at a cloud.
It's coming full circle in a way, or half circle, full circle, something like that. And I also think that's a great way to end this episode. So thanks a lot to Alexander, first of all, for sending that question. And you can send any question that you'd like with the hashtag AskStackTrace on Twitter. And please do that, because we do love to get your questions. We love when you can influence the content of the show, and we'll try to answer as many questions as we can. So please keep that up. Thanks also to iMacing for sponsoring this episode, making it all possible. Check them out at iMacing.com/StackTrace. But most of all, thank you so much for listening, everybody, and we'll talk to you again next week. So, say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.